as I was pulling out of St. John's Abbey, I was at an Episcopal church retreat for the diaconate, and I was reading Render Unto Rome, The Secret Life of Money in the Catholic Church while I was on the campus. And there's an abbey that's on the campus of this very well-respected university with a terrific football program, by the way. It's one of those great small-town, you know, college success stories of the last several years. But while I was reading the book, I was in between breaks and stuff during our conferences. I had more people come up and ask me about this book. I almost didn't know what to expect. Jason Barry, having written Vows of Silence, his last book about the clergy sex abuse scandal, and this book being a carryover from that in a way, talking about the secret life of money in the Catholic Church as a result of how these bills got paid and all the things that would happen with money. But it was very well received. Everybody who walked up to me, whether they were a monk, whether it was a layperson, was somebody visiting, everybody was very interested in this idea of how the money is handled. I think it speaks to a concern within and without the church to try to understand exactly what's happening with the money, which brings us back to a very natural conversation about the Vatican Bank. What is the Vatican Bank? And what can they do? Who oversees the Vatican Bank? Can you just get an account at the Vatican Bank? Can you open up one? Do you get a toaster if you deposit more than $200? We'll find out coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So there you go, Jason Barry. When I was on the campus over there at near the seminary, as well as the wonderful school, everybody was interested in your book, Render Unto Rome, every time they saw the title.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that.
And there was a certain irony of that, too, is that unless and they may have been moved, and I don't know, I actually tried to find out on the internet and I couldn't confirm it, but two of the better known pedophile priests in Minnesota were still being housed at one point in the abbey there on the campus, outside of the reach of the law. But that brings us back to exactly how all of this functions within the church. And I was kind of surprised, the Vatican Bank, I mean, we think the Vatican, and we think, you know, all of the beautiful things that are about the Vatican, but Vatican Bank, that's a little bit more of seems more conceptual than an actual, than institutional. Can you explain that?
Well, the Vatican Bank has really a fascinating history. And it was founded in 1942 by Pope Pius XII in the middle of World War II, when the Nazis were marching across Europe. And the Vatican had substantial investments since 1929, when the Holy See and the Italian state reached an agreement on the reparation, the payment of funds to the Vatican for lost territories during the Italian War of Unity, the Risorgimento in the 19th century. And there was a guy named Bernardino Nogara, who was a very wise investor, and he had a very adroit policy of investing the funds from what the Italian state had paid the Holy See for these properties in an array of international accounts. Well, when the war erupted, the Vatican established its own bank to have consolidation, much greater control in the event that Italy might fall, which indeed it did to the Nazis. In 1948, after the war, the Vatican Bank became the primary vessel through which the CIA routed millions of dollars and various American supporters of the Christian Democrats, the party that was competing with the Communist Party of Italy, in those pivotal 1948 elections. So what you have was the Pope's bank essentially becoming the means through which a lot of campaign support went to the political party that was locked in political combat against the Communist Party. From there, as the bank emerged, it basically became a kind of holding company or an offshore bank located in this tiny international state. The Vatican State is only about 108 acres and it, of course, has its own embassies from foreign countries, people who are posted there. The United States has an ambassador to Rome and an ambassador to the Vatican. It got into trouble in the 1980s when an archbishop named Paul Marcinkus, an American, basically cut a deal with two pretty notorious figures, Roberto Calvi and Michele Sindona. Sindona was, he was a mobster, and he was moving drug money through laundered accounts. Calvi had a bank that was doing business with him, and Marcinkus allowed them to use various accounts in the Vatican Bank. When Calvi's bank crashed, it created a huge chain reaction, and Calvi was eventually found hung under a bridge in London. Sindona went to prison, was poisoned, and died in prison. We don't know who poisoned him. And Marcinkus had a standing subpoena from the Italian government, but because he was living inside the Vatican as an international state, they couldn't go over and simply arrest him. And so in the end, the Vatican agreed to pay a $242 million fine. And after the fine was paid and all accounts settled, Marcinkus left Italy and went back to the United States and passed his sunset years in Arizona playing golf.
So, again, it so often happens, and you do it deftly in the book, Render Unto Rome. You ask that question all the time is, what did the Vatican know and when did they know it, essentially? And when did they know they were dealing with a mobster and they were sort of using the Vatican Bank to
launder money?
To launder the money divinely.
Well, I don't think they laundered it divinely. If anything, they did it profanely or humanly.
you know what I mean.
The history of that long scandal is so complex, and I've read just about every major book on it. And it's very difficult to figure out at what point Marcinkus really did understand what he was doing, because he had no background as a banker. This was not his field, and he simply, learned it on the job. The short answer is, we don't really know. But there's an interesting sequel to that story. Last fall, the Italian authorities, the banking authorities, impounded $30 million that the Vatican Bank had sent to two different to accounts in two different banks in Italy. One was in Frankfurt, one was in Italy. And because of the large amounts of money being transferred, the financial regulators took a microscopic look, decided it didn't pass the smell test, and impounded the money. This created a huge furor. The head of the Vatican Bank, who interestingly is a member of Opus Dei, and is a respected economist in Italy, Tedeschi is his name, announced that this was a misunderstanding, nothing was wrong, the funds should not have been impounded. But the Pope, nevertheless, decided to establish an oversight board for this bank. It took them 9 months to negotiate the release of those funds. They have just been returned within the last month. What's interesting about this is that the problem the Vatican Bank has now run into is that international banking regulations are getting stiffer when it comes to moving large amounts of money because of the fear of terrorist financing and the money that's typically moved by drug lords and narcotics gangsters. So what you have is a bank that has a history of special clients alongside the 40 or 50,000 members, account holders who are members of religious orders. And here's where it really gets interesting. Religious orders in Rome put their money in the Vatican Bank. And every year, the Pope receives a certain amount of money from the bank for his charities. Many of the envelopes with money that he gives to bishops who come to make their every fifth year report to the Supreme Pontiff, these are called ad limina reports. Many of these bishops from deeply impoverished countries are given stipends. They're given envelopes. They're given sometimes cash, sometimes checks. But this is a tradition of the Pope helping bishops from poor countries. Nothing wrong with that. But the bank itself is off the books, which means is when the Holy See issues its financial statement every summer, it has no accounting of the Vatican Bank. So we don't really know how much is in the bank, where the investments are, but we know it does have a lot of money.
Can the average person just open up an account, by the way, at a Vatican Bank near them? I mean, do you get a Vatican Bank ATM card? I mean, is there anything like...
Interestingly, the ATM cards are in Latin.
are they really? And yeah. They have them?
Yeah.
I want one.
I don't speak for the Vatican Bank. I don't know what its public policy is, but I would doubt that a quote-unquote average citizen could. It is supposedly there to service the many religious orders and, religious figures who are headquartered in Rome. But as I say, I quoted from a long report in the Financial Times that cited an Italian banking regulator who said that it had been used, in essence, as an offshore bank for many years, and this official said that that had to change. You know, whether the banking industry of Italy will maintain a kind of forceful position on this, I guess, is an open question, but at least for now, the Vatican has established a kind of regulatory board and said that they will bring it into the modern world of banking. I should add, in fairness to the Vatican Bank, when you use the term banking regulators in the United States, it doesn't have a lot of heft when you look at what Wall Street has done to our economy.
Right. True. Well, at least, but there was some oversight, as bad as it may have been. There was at least some.
Well, that's another conversation. I'm not sure how much there was. But at least in Rome, there is now, a protocol being developed between the Italian state and the Vatican Bank.
So in the new book, you do address some issues that, again, sort of link the clergy sex abuse scandal and some of the financial abuses and or just even unregulated money flow within the Catholic Church, starting at the parochial level and going all the way up to the Vatican. And there's a piece of this which I wanted to amplify from last hour, if I can. And that is, we talked about how there were some of these priests that were living in a fairly openly gay environment. The Vatican knew about it. In the case of some of them, they simply were looking the other way. And part of the history of this is that there were seminaries, as you point out in the case of Christopher Kuntz, there were seminaries where it seemed like this was very acceptable behavior.
Excuse me. That's not correct. Christopher Kuntz was a member of the Legion of Christ, which is an arch-conservative religious order.
Right.
And I have never found any indication that there was toleration of homosexual activity in that religious order.
No. But you're missing your paragraph where you talk about how he went to a seminary before he became a legionary, right?
And he went in
and he got hit on. And he got hit on several times until he left seminary from that particular...
That was in Milwaukee, yes. You're absolutely correct.
And so then he ends up becoming, going to another order, which was stricter and had more controls and stuff. But isn't that interesting that he had that experience of going into the seminary as a young man and saying, whoa! And it seems to be, I thought, at least by indication, something that was kind of institutionalized in there. In that particular seminary, they seemed to be that kind of thing was not being punished. It wasn't being rooted out at the time, right?
Well, yes. You, and I do stand corrected on the. I thought you were talking about originally his long experience with the Legion of Christ. Yeah, look, there have been lavender cultures in a lot of seminaries, and there's a large gay priest population. But I think it's important to underscore two things here. First of all, there are a lot of fine priests who happen to be gay.
And of course.
To assume that, these men are not good priests just because they're gay, I think is unfair. That said, however, there are cliques that have developed in seminaries and dioceses of men. You know, the real problem is clericalism, and it's the idea that the priesthood is a privileged caste, and men who are in this, clerical culture, which has its own internal system of rewards, can pretty much act with a sense of entitlement. Not all priests act that way, but no. More than a few do. You find it historically, among sort of clubby groups of Irish and Italian priests who kind of hang together and enjoy vacations and things like that. Well, unfortunately, there is in this rather, sprawling gay culture within the priesthood today, a strand of men who lead very comfortable lives and, have found the priesthood a good place to have a comfortable living. How committed they are, to the pastoral work of the church, I suppose is something that it would take a sociologist many years to determine. Well, but it's interesting how many
I just want to jump in and say that's not what I mean. And I think we got rerouted because, I work in the Episcopal Church, and I'm all about gay clergy. I don't have any problem with that at all. The issue to me was just it was the double life of it. I mean, and that what that provided was really all I was going for there was that there seemed to be areas where some places people looked the other way and other places where they didn't. And that provided, it seems like, a cover for some people who would be kind of in one circle. And if they got in one circle, then that opened up, everybody was keeping each other's secrets, and then that again would open up for more potential financial abuse or more that's what I was getting at, was that there's sort of like the circles within the circles from people who are all kind of in the know as to what's going on.
Well, certainly with the largest organization on the earth, you will have internal circles and internal cliques and things like that. I wouldn't dispute that.
Yeah, but I just mean that was the part I thought was interesting, that and we don't know which one of the bishops and the cardinals yet. We don't know everything about how people at the top may have come through those cliques and those circles, and were protecting the people that were behind them because they knew the secret too. I mean, everybody could rat on each other, or everybody can just continue to protect each other and not let it get out.
Well, yeah, whistleblowers in the Catholic Church are people who have to show intestinal fortitude. I mean, Father Thomas Doyle, for example, for years has been one of the foremost advocates for clergy abuse survivors, even testifying in cases. And there are other priests, who have spoken out quite valiantly. I think what we're looking at right now is a slow breakdown of the kind of sweeping financial strength that the church once had. The number of bankruptcies in different parts of the country by diocese and in a couple of cases religious orders has really, in a sense, opened a window on the fragility of the finances. When you have a diocese like San Diego, which sits on some of the richest real estate in the Western Hemisphere, when they were involved in these settlements, the bishop took Chapter 11 rather than testify in a trial. The bankruptcy drew a decision by the judge, herself a Catholic, who decided that she wanted to get an independent financial audit of the diocese.
You're gonna have to hang on to that. We'll pick it up right there on that independent audit from the judge. We'll get back to that in just a moment, and we'll run some other numbers by you. that are in the book Render Unto Rome. Jason Berry next. Yeah, it's all about the money, money, money at the new book Render Unto Rome. It's really about how money is used within the church. Where does it go? How does it flow? Who's watching over it? You'd be surprised for the amount of money we're talking about and the small amount of oversight. So it opens it up for a huge amount of embezzlement, which goes on every year, both at the very lowest level to the very highest level. There are whole pension accounts now which aren't funded because that money had to be rerouted somewhere else. And then that doesn't even begin to get into some of the issues around church property that came up around the settlements for the clergy sex abuse. And that just brings us right back to Jason Berry and that conversation about that judge in San Diego. We'll get to that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So Jason Berry was just telling us about the settlement in San Diego, the diocese there having some very valuable property. And so roll that back a little bit and pick it up. So the church decided to just file Chapter 11 and try to hold on to as much as they could?
Well, they were trying to bargain down in the settlements. And, you know, when you take Chapter 11, you have to disclose all of your assets. Chapter 11 bankruptcy is really a way to reorganize a company or a nonprofit, as the case may be, so that you can get control of your assets and then work out a payment plan for your debts. The diocese was facing a substantial payout on these settlements, and everyone who covered this and the lawyers involved were all of the view that it was really a bargaining device. It was almost like a delaying tactic to try to bargain down the opposition, so to speak. The risk, the gamble in doing something like that is that you have to put all your assets on the table. And so the judge wanted to make sure that this was all done in a way that would ensure that all of the assets were documented. So she appointed a special master, in effect, who was a former FBI agent, a forensic accountant. He went in, did an entire review of the diocese, found a property that they had never listed, noted that on certain financial transactions, they had listed parishes as part of their overall base of assets, and yet in other transactions had not done that. He discovered lucrative waterfront property they owned, which had not been listed. And in the end, the judge excoriated the diocese. I mean, lectured them, scolded them. And the judge was herself a Catholic. And so in the end, they had to pay a substantial amount of money just for the filing of Chapter 11. And they got no advantage and ended up having to pay the large settlements that ended up being $98 million. So, you know, when you have such a vast organization that is so decentralized, the movement of money is really a story of personality, how a given bishop governs his diocese. And, you know, what Bishop Brahm of San Diego did was, frankly, reckless. And it ended up costing him more money in the long run by taking the Chapter 11 gambit, so to speak. Whereas in other parts of the country, you know, there are, I think, are bishops who have worked mightily to try to maintain the religious infrastructure. Bottom line is, a Catholic parish has closed on average once a week for the last 15 years. The church is expanding into suburbs, but I could not get corresponding data on how many new parishes have opened. Some of the parishes that have closed have done so because of demographic changes. The neighborhood changes, people move out, especially if it becomes more poor and you don't have as many Catholics living in it. You know, we can sort of understand the pragmatism of selling a church in a situation like that. But when financial pressures come down and bishops resort to these mechanisms of closing churches in order to sell them, churches in good neighborhoods where they have money in the bank, it really becomes an issue of human justice.
I want to pick at those numbers a little bit more because I thought you did that so well in the book, Render Unto Rome, where you were talking about, and I mentioned this number earlier, the average Catholic donates, what was it, $320? According to the last year that this data became about, $320 a year,
yep,
or something like
a
that?
Year.
And then the average Protestant was like $695 or something. So what? Why the disparity?
Well, there are a couple of reasons for it. One reason is that because the Catholic Church is so large, many Catholics feel that they do not have to tithe, that is, pay maybe 10% of their income, whether it's 10% or 5%. Because when you have so many people, everyone can give a little bit less, and you can still have enough going into the cash flow, whereas Protestant churches are smaller, and the denominations are not as large, and people historically tend to give more. Now, that's one explanation. The other explanation, and Father Andrew Greeley, the sociologist, has written about this, is that people, Catholics, do not trust their bishops. They have allegiance to the parish, but they don't feel comfortable with the way the bishops are governing things, and so they just tend to give less. Now, if a parish needs, for example, to do an overhaul of the church, if it needs restoration work, you'll have a funding drive for that specific purpose. But the level of support of bishops among Catholics is historically low. In 2002, during the height of the abuse crisis, USA Today did a poll which found that 89% of Catholics felt that a bishop who had concealed or recycled a child abuser should be removed from his position. Well, I think that mentality has carried over in some places toward the way some bishops use money. Boston is a good example. Cardinal O'Malley, although ironically he has issued the most detailed financial statements of just about any archdiocese in the country, nevertheless, he has been unable to raise the level of money that they need in order to meet their operating. They've been running deficits now for almost 10 years. And what's sad about that is that he really inherited a disaster, but by closing churches, he lost the trust of many people. And the number of people who have left the church in Boston is almost 30% now. It has been a huge sea change, and the finances follow right along.
The number of priests per parishioner, what was the best number versus what's the number typically now?
Oh, well, in years past, there have been something like two or three priests in a given parish, sometimes 3,000 and 4,000 families in these parishes. Very few parishes today have more than one priest living in the rectory. I think it's one for every 1,600 now. And the numbers are continuing to go down because of the priest shortage. And, you know, that is really where the church is experiencing one of its greatest financial challenges. And the reason for this is that the pastor is the primary fundraiser. A bishop's financial base is only as strong as his priests, because the priests, Sunday after Sunday, are the ones who minister and pastor and preach, and the trust that people have in their given pastor is reflected in how well they support their parish. The priest shortage is acute. There is not a successor generation emerging. There's been an 80% drop in the number of seminarians, and all the studies I've read, and it's been a pretty widespread base of literature by various researchers, all underscore the fact that mandatory celibacy has become unpopular, that priests today are, I should say, men today who are drawn to the priesthood are far less inclined to go in than they were, say, two generations ago. And the reason is celibacy. Quick number for you. In New Orleans, where I live, last year there were two men ordained to the priesthood. And 85 people got degrees in religious studies or campus ministry from Loyola University. So, you know, on the assumption that maybe only 10 of those 85 might have gone on to the priesthood had it been available, that's still five times as many who were actually ordained in that year.
Sure.
So the reason I call it a financial challenge is if they keep losing priests at the rate that the church is going, the financial support of the parishes and the dioceses will continue to diminish as well, because priests are the primary fundraisers. Now, I'm certainly no Pollyanna on issues of the church, but I would say this: if they change the celibacy law, and particularly if they allow women to become priests, it may not seem like something that, you know, will happen tomorrow, but I think in due course, perhaps within 15 or 20 years, you know, it's possible that it might happen. Whenever it does happen, I think we will see a springtime for the Catholic Church and a rejuvenation.
Yeah,
whether that happens soon enough is really the big question, because to me, what is going on in the church today is something like the earthquake in a political sense that we see happening in Egypt. You know, the hunger for freedom, the desires that people have for lives that allow them to live with dignity and earn money. If they do actually put Mubarak on trial in Egypt, what it means is that country that was long ruled by an autocrat will be moving towards a kind of justice system. And that is what the Catholic Church desperately needs, a bona fide system of justice. And I think at such time that occurs, what we'll see is a reverse of this long erosion that has marked the church through these scandals and the long aching crisis that is before it today.
Well, of course, and the great irony here is that the belief was that by making priests be celibate, it wouldn't create a culture where people would claim that they have a right to inherit church property or church office. And so one of the reasons why celibacy was understood as a necessity in the church is that it meant that, you know, all of the church's resources stayed within the church and they weren't going to be allocated out to the oldest son or a wife in a divorce or whatever. And so it was part of that was about the property, but having church celibacy and having people that are in the priesthood that shouldn't have been there, it ends up being about the property anyway. And it ends
up being... Well, you're absolutely right, Ian. And that is the central irony of this book. Look, when I began researching Render Unto Rome, one of the things that really jumped out at me was a book that a historian, James Brundage, had done. And he says, this is a learned study of the Middle Ages, and he says that one of the reasons the church imposed celibacy was to prevent the emergence of dynasties where a priest has a large family and, you know, five of the sons will inherit large, you know, swaths of territory of a given area around a church. They wanted to prevent dynasties from arising. Now, we can look back on that today and kind of chuckle at it, but you put yourself back in the mind of the Middle Ages and you've got monarchies that control huge amounts of land, baronies, lower nobility, all of these people scrambling to get their piece of the rock, and the church wanted to ensure that it had substantial holdings, and it was trying to establish itself as basically the legal system of European society. And it succeeded at that in many places for quite some time. The world has changed many times over since then, and my own view is that celibacy is really a relic of an age that has passed. I can certainly understand it for monasteries and religious communities of that kind. But for a diocesan clergy, it has really become a great impediment to the change that the church so desperately needs to make.
Before we wrap things up and offer you up to phone calls and comments coming up next hour on Coast to Coast, What were some of the most amazing things that you learned about the way money is handled within the Catholic Church, from what you thought as both a Catholic and a previous writer about the secret inner workings of the Catholic Church? What were the things that made your jaw drop?
Well, you know, I went to Jesuit schools, and I grew up in harmony with the faith. I think what really struck me, and what one of the things that really got me going on this book, was a story I covered in New Orleans, where I live, involving two churches that the Archbishop in 2008 decided to close. One was on the National Register of Historic Places, and to sell a church on the National Register of Historic Places in a city having, you know, the aftershocks of Hurricane Katrina struck me as just foolhardy. I couldn't understand what his logic was. He had previously tried to close the oldest African-American church in the city 6 months after the hurricane, and people literally occupied. People were in the churches. It was one of the most volatile social protests the city had seen in years. And, it was clear that St. Augustine Church in the Treme neighborhood, which is now so popular because of the TV series, it was clear that this church, even though it needed a lot of renovation work, was prime real estate. You know, you're six blocks from the French Quarter. It was built in 1842. It's a beautiful structure, obviously needs some work. But the side yard was a city block large, and people held fairs there. You could park 150 cars there. And he would never admit it, but everybody assumed that he wanted to do it for the real estate. Here's an area undergoing gentrification. Finally, months later, after he backed down and they let the church stay open, even though he got rid of the popular pastor, I got a hold of a document, internal minutes of the priest's council. And what they basically said was, we don't want to reveal our financial plan lest it become subject to media scrutiny, and then it would mess everything up. And they were admitting that they really didn't have a plan. They were going to close the churches and then try to figure out what to do with them. But it was clear that real estate lay behind it. That, to me, was one of the real eye-openers.
As you learn more about the embezzlement and the figures, I thought they were staggering figures for what money goes unaccounted for, and how even like as those poor priests who had their pension funds raided in order to pay for other things, you think, well, where's the accountability for that? Part of what made my jaw drop reading your book is the number of people who did horrible things. I'm just going to say, my opinion, horrible things, and yet were allowed to fail up. They were promoted up into a more prestigious place and protected even more for criticism for what they had done at the
Bishop Richard Lennon of Cleveland is a good example of that. He was the architect of the widely unpopular program in Boston called Reconfiguration, which was a way of closing parishes and a ham-fisted attempt to simply take the money of these parishes to plug the deficit. And he became so alienated from his own cardinal, his own immediate superior, if you will, Sean O'Malley, that he woke up one morning, Lennon did, to read in the Boston Globe that O'Malley said Reconfiguration was his worst nightmare. And he literally, the cardinal, woke up some mornings wishing that he could, be taken away, meaning that his life would end.
He
was
killed.
Terribly depressed. And I interviewed many priests who, in meetings with him, said that O'Malley was clearly depressed by this. So what did they do? The Vatican sent Lennon to Cleveland, where he is the bishop today, and he has had armed guards go with him into parishes that he has closed. He has insisted on giving the final mass, and there are policemen standing next to him or near him at the altar. He has closed some three dozen churches. I interview a city councilman in Cleveland in the book, Mike Polenzik, who talks quite bitterly about going to the parish where his grandmother was a loyal parishioner for many years, watching it be literally destroyed, razed, torn down before his eyes, a Spanish mission architecture church of that style.
Hang on to that thought, and we'll get to your questions and comments, too, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.